vulnerability around these things and opening up conversations about our gender and our sexuality and the contours of that in our lives isn't easy, as has already been mentioned, whether it's in a public space or whether it's even privately amongst couples who love each other, trying to navigate your way forward in conversations that are helpful and that table all that's a part of that for you is challenging. The passage that we're looking at today, did you read it out earlier? Because I had to duck out to the... So it did get read out, that's good. It is one which, in the context of this big thing that we're looking at, the end of us and them, is one that I thought was worth digging into around this area of particularly sexuality. And not that I intend in this message to drill down. We're looking forward next year to actually having an opportunity to look more at issues around gender, sexuality and sex. But we're looking in a more bigger picture way at this whole theme in Jesus' life of inclusion. And particularly in this instance, for this story, is with somebody who has been deemed to be a sexual sinner. So has been excluded from community, has been seen in a particular way because of that aspect of their life. So in just offering a few thoughts on this passage, I was reminded of a story that Philip Yancey tells in his book, What's So Amazing About Grace. And he writes about a woman who approached a friend of his asking for some help. And his friend told him, as he tells the story, he puts it like this. She was working as a prostitute, homeless, sick, and unable to buy food for her two-year-old daughter. Through sobs and tears, she told me she had been renting out her daughter, 2 years old, to men interested in kinky sex. She made more renting out of her daughter than she could in her own work. She said she had to do it to support her own drug habit. I could hardly bear hearing this sordid, horrific story, and I had no idea what to say to this woman, he said. So he listened for a period of time. And then he said to Yancey, at last I asked if she had ever thought of going to a church for help. I will never forget the look of pure shock that crossed her face. Church, she cried. Why would I ever go there? I already feel terrible about myself, and they'll just make me feel worse. I think the story that is offered to us in the Gospels is one which captures something of that. A sense of why would you go to a religious community to seek to get some insight into the way you're experiencing your sexuality? Or why would you go to a church to get support when you're struggling with some aspect of that? Or others within a church community. Yancey says that what struck me most about my friend's story is that woman, much like this prostitute, fled towards Jesus, not away from him. The worse a person feels about themselves, the more likely they saw Jesus as a refuge. And then he asked the question, has the church lost this? Has the church lost this gift? So our text or our story today can help us to see why sinners, especially sexual sinners, and when I use that term, I want to use it in a specific way today. I'm going to use that as a descriptor of those whom the community sees as not conforming to their expectations in both their gender and their sexuality. So it can help us see why sexual sinners flee from religious communities or hide when they are in them. And I believe it can also show us, as a community of Christ follows, how we can tune into Jesus' heart and recover the lost gift of being a safe and healing harbour for people who are marginalised because of their sexual sins, real or perceived. So let's think about this story for a moment, and let's think about the Pharisee. We can just pop that picture up there. So Jesus tells us that this Pharisee invited Jesus to dine with him, and Jesus entered the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. It also tells us that when the woman who the gospel writer tells us had lived a sinful life in that town came in and started touching Jesus, the man had a visceral reaction to that. There was shock, there was disgust, there was horror. He said to himself, if this man were a prophet, if he were truly a spiritual or religious person, a holy person, someone with insight into the character and the purposes of God in the world, he would know who and what sort of woman this is who's touching him, that she's a sinner. And so he has this internal monologue going on. So why this reaction for this religious leader in this community? Well, we know, looking at the story, that her designation within the story by the author marks her out, in all probability, as a prostitute, someone who would be seen to be contagious in her impurity, and probably somebody who also fraternized with Gentile soldiers, Roman soldiers, occupying forces within the village. Her services would have been provided as a sex worker to some of those people as well. So someone who is doubly impure in the eyes of the religious establishment. Her actions would have also been regarded, as we read on to the story, we'll see this, at least by the men present, as erotic. Letting her hair down would have been something that they, along with the fondling of Jesus' feet and the use of her hair, as something that would be like a slave girl or a prostitute providing sexual favours. So this is something that created this disturbance and the force, definitely, within the room, this rising sense of discomfort and uncertainty. What is Jesus doing? And what we know about the background of these Pharisees is that they were in many ways the religious leaders of the community. They were highly influential. And their chief concern in terms of their, if you like, spiritual framework was that the Jewish people would be pure and faithful to God's law, separate from pagan cultural influences. So it's important to realize that the picture that you possibly carry within your own mind, if you've been around church for a long time, of the Pharisees is probably a misshaped and inaccurate one. Often they're painted as the hypocritical villains. The people who, you know, are vehemently opposed to the good purposes of God. But that's certainly not the way that they saw themselves. In their minds, they were the protagonists. They were the protectors of the true faith. They were defending Israel against heretical beliefs, unlawful practices, and unholy people. That's how they saw themselves. They were the gatekeepers of Judaism. Somebody's figured out that within the Torah, or the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, there are about 613 commandments. And what the Pharisees determined was that wasn't adequate. You had to build a buffer zone around those laws to ensure that people wouldn't break them. So you introduced multiple other traditions and laws and practices so that the people wouldn't come anywhere near breaking the rule that they felt was important. So in a sense, they became the boundary riders, you know, circulating around to make sure that people weren't engaging in acts that would even bring them close to breaching the law of God as they understood it. Professor Anthony Soldarini says this about the Pharisees. They were the defenders of a certain kind of community, and Jesus challenged their vision of community by attacking their purity regulations concerning food, washing, and Sabbath practice. The effect of Jesus' teaching was to widen the community boundaries and loosen the norms for membership in this community. Jesus thus created a new community outside the Pharisees' control, which provoked their hostility. So you can see that fundamentally what's going on for this Pharisee sitting there watching Jesus do this is a threat to the whole way of life, to the purity of the people, to their faithfulness to the covenant of God as they understand it. And so he's horrified by the sight of this woman touching Jesus. He's recoiling on the inside. He's got this very heated internal monologue going on. And I want to suggest that in some way, Simon here is illustrative of somebody who's stuck in a dualistic us and them thinking. There's the holy and the unholy, the clean and the unclean, the law keepers and the law breakers, the insiders and the outsiders, or as my mokapuna would say, the goodies and the baddies. Our little kids, you know, they're running around. They want to know who's the goodie and who's the baddie. And it was kind of like, in this sense, this is this framework that Simon is stuck in. He can only feel safe. He can identify who's in and who's out, who's good and who's bad, who's clean and is unclean. He's got to avoid at all costs any form of impurity within himself, which can come through contamination in contact with these people. So keep in mind that this desire is born this view is born out of a desire to be faithful to God as God is understood. In fact, I think all of us in our lives are doing that, aren't we, on our journey? We're seeking in some way, shape, or form to conform our lives to what we anticipate, expect, think God would want of us. But this way of thinking led him to judge, condemn, and exclude the woman and Jesus. Jesus can't be a prophet, and the woman can't be a holy person. It led him to conclude that they didn't belong in the community of God. And arguably, this preoccupation with religious purity leads to the Pharisees engaging in the murder of Jesus. He is a threat to community as they know it. Community will have to be radically reformed if they are to act in the way that Jesus is acting. They will have to allow people who they currently exclude to be included. And they don't want to budge. They don't want to move. So there's this massive challenge sitting here on the table. Something that was mentioned earlier, I think Amy may have referred to it, is purity culture. And during the 1990s, there was this movement within evangelicalism in the US that found its way into parts of the church here in New Zealand as well. And it was popularized in books such as I Kissed Dating Goodbye by somebody called Joshua Harris. And it was also promoted by groups such as True Love Waits. And the movement emphasized not having sex before marriage, promoted courtship, over-dating. Promoters and advocates argued that you shouldn't date or even kiss someone unless you were sure you were going to marry them. Sexual thoughts and most sexual conduct and sex outside marriage were elevated to unforgivable sins in the eyes of some. And the programs that they put in place, including in schools, were frequently referred to still are in some cases, is abstinent programs posing as sex education for youth, but not providing any information on sexual health, contraception, consent, or personal skills. So there have been some piercing critiques made of this movement. At best, it was an attempt to help people value sex as something precious. At worst, it was ill-informed, abusive, and very, very destructive. But can you see the parallel between what was happening there in the Christian church and what the Pharisees are doing here? It's not sufficient to kind of have some ethic of what how sexuality must be expressed in the world. You must build a fence around it. You must surround it with additional rules and laws and perceptions and regulations in order for this to be kept pure. There's a lot of parallels between what is going on in the Gospels with the Pharisees and their view of their sexual sinners. And there is here within, and there was within that movement. So let me just say for a moment here that I personally don't believe the answer to purity culture is what has been a reaction, which you might call hookup culture. But that's a subject for another day. Our text isn't speaking to that. It's speaking to this obsession with purity that then has become so damaging and was so damaging in Jesus' day. Like the Pharisees, purity culture sought to build a fence around its understanding of godly sexual behavior to protect a Christian sexual ethic. It ended up shaming, shunning, and damaging those who failed to live by those standards, those who didn't share their views, keep their rules, or conform to their group. One of the authors I was reading was talking about the toll that exclusion takes. You see, when you're focused on exclusion, all of your energy is going into defining boundaries, building walls, patrolling borders, policing citizens, punishing transgressors, and exiling offenders. And you know what that does? It just dehumanizes us. Nobody wins. Everybody loses. In communities of exclusion, Cole Arthur Riley writes, the energy you expend on preventing others from walking through the door of community is only matched by the energy you expend competing to stay inside. So what about Jesus? What does Jesus do in this instant that is so different? Well, he certainly responds to the woman in a totally different way to the way Simon the Pharisee does. He welcomes her presence. He accepts her hospitality. He declares her to be forgiven. He defends her actions. He commends her love. He affirms her faith and he gives her peace. Astounding. Astounding. Whereas the Pharisee Simon is having this visceral reaction away, Jesus is moved towards. And God isn't repulsed by sin. God seems to be drawn in Christ to sin. While we are still sinners, God gives the best of himself to us in Christ. Not after we're reformed, not after we're cleaned up, not after we've met the standards of approval. And Jesus uses this simple little parable, doesn't he, to teach about love, acceptance, and forgiveness. He tells the story to Simon, noticing his reaction, maybe noticing his body language, noticing the tensing in his face, maybe noticing him leaning away from the woman. But Jesus discerns what's going on in this internal monologue. So he delivers this little story about two people who are in debt to a debtor. Both of them owe money, but one owes an enormous amount. I did a calculation based on Stats New Zealand's 2022 medium hourly earnings rate. So $8,200 over against $86,000. You might have to do a calculation later for me, Andrew, but you know, there's this enormous gap that's kind of portrayed in the story. Jesus says one person just owes a small amount, another person owes a large amount. If they're both forgiven, who's going to love the most? And Simon grudgingly says, well, I suppose the one who's forgiven the most. It's kind of like he doesn't want to say. He'd rather just not be asked a question by Jesus. How many of us kind of feel the same, really? Just ask someone else, Jesus. Don't ask me. But he gets asked the question. And the really interesting thing here, I find in the story, one of them is the forgiveness the woman receives isn't granted on the basis of her love. It's given on the basis of God's unconditional love and mercy. She doesn't do anything to warrant this love. The way Luke is telling the story, he's saying this love that she's expressing for Jesus is born out of an awareness that the gift of forgiveness that God offers to all of humanity has been made known to us in a way that it never was before in Jesus. Because Jesus comes to declare the Jubilee, the acceptable year of the Lord, the fact that debts are forgiven. Remember the beginning of the gospel, we started there, Luke chapter 4. And so this is radical, unilateral forgiveness. It's shocking forgiveness. It reaches beyond what we might call therapeutic forgiveness that releases resentment in us, or social forgiveness that seeks to heal the breaches in community or relationship, or quid pro quo forgiveness, which requires one party to meet certain conditions before extending the forgiveness or releasing it. This here is unconditional, prevenient, and restorative forgiveness. And what Jesus tells Simon and Jesus makes clear to those listening is that we all stand within the community of the forgiven. We all stand in need of that forgiveness, but we all stand as recipients of it. So divine forgiveness refuses to let the other person's faults and failings, real or perceived, or the offenses we've registered against them, determine their value, define their identity, or prescribe the full contours of the relationship that we will have with them. That is a game changer. And that is the game changer in this story right here. Because there is no us in them. There's only us. All of us sitting under the umbrella of the forgiveness of God. All having failed to love as we should, all having mismanaged and struggled and failed in the management of our sexuality in different ways, we all stand together in this. I find it really interesting looking at the story, you know, just seeing how this forgiveness and experience of it is the genesis of this woman's love. And how it's born out of that, and how Jesus deliberately contrasts in order to bring this home to Simon and help him to be aware that he stands in this place too. There's a repeat of a little phrase in verses 42 and 47 where Jesus says, "You did not," to Simon, "give me water, but she has bathed her tears, them with her tears and wiped them with her feet. You did not give me a kiss," a greeting which would have been extended, customary hospitality within that Eastern environment, "but she hasn't finished kissing my feet since the time I came in and I entered. You did not, Simon, anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with oil." And you know, Jesus draws attention to Simon. He's trying to bring it home. Simon, don't you realize that you sit in need of and under the umbrella of this forgiveness as well? This woman gets it. She gets it. The weight of her failings is sat upon her shoulders and it's been lifted. And this love that she's bringing is in response to that. You're not getting it, Simon. Come on, I want you to get it. I want you to get it. Because community is transformed when we get it. It was mentioned earlier that in our own world of Christian church, in different ways throughout the centuries, sexual sinners, those who have been perceived to have failed to have met particular gender and sexuality norms and standards, have been seen by Christian people as the most unclean and the most unforgivable in many ages, or more unclean and less forgivable. And different groups throughout the ages have been seen in this kind of way. Sexual sinners have been scandalized and demonized, marginalized, ostracized in multiple ways within the Christian church, perhaps more so than any other group. I suspect there's a lot of transference and projection that's going on. A lot. And it's still going on today. I find a massive challenge in this story, and that shift of focus into understanding who we are under the umbrella of God's unconditional love and scandalous forgiveness that draws us together even in this area of our human experience in ways that, standing within the context of a purity worldview, steal from us. It doesn't answer all the questions, but it opens up the pathway towards the place where the kingdom of God can truly find expression. This story is a little window for us. Let me finish briefly with something in my world that had me just sitting under a tree in tears one day. In my former work as a te aparani, as a chaplain with Te Rōpū o te Taumata Kohatu, Meki Stepping Stone Trust, we had many rainbow kaimahi staff. And we also had within our tangata whai ora, our tangata whai kaha, the people who were on a journey towards wellness. We had many people who were also people who were LGBTQAI+. And within the organisation, many of these people, for different reasons, because it was a Christian organisation, felt unsafe and insecure and uncertain about their role. Sometimes, sadly, Christian people, and I was present when it happened, would make comments about these people that were derogatory and were homophobic and transphobic at times. And so we created a little space. Some of them came and talked about, well, can we have just an opportunity to provide support to people within the organisation and talk through some of these issues. And one of the women who was a part of this group, I would join them, and as things were talked about and experiences were shared, and you know, one of the tragic things I heard in the first group when we met together was, you know, what's it been like for those of you who've had Christian people in your lives, you know, maybe church people, and every one of them in the group said, you know, when I came out or I let people know, this is my experience of my gender and my sexuality, this is who I understand myself to be, that the people, they said, they in most instances, they didn't jump and judge us, but they just disappeared. They drifted out of our lives and we were left on our own. They abandoned us. The people we journey with abandoned us. And we sitting in this group was just such an important but painful and rich experience for me, and listening to those stories. Because my own journey in this space, of course, like all of us, is a personal one with changes as well, and challenges and pain, trying to figure things out. But in just bringing this together, the thing that touched me was sitting under this tree with one of the women in the group, who said, you know, it's been really good to be a part of this, and it's been really good getting to know you. She's brought up in a cult where she was sexually abused as well. She said, but I feel safe under this tree with you. And it's been good to be able to have somebody to start talking about these things with. And even though I don't kind of believe in God yet, I kind of feel like that Maybe I can. Just to be a little bit apart, a little small part of somebody's story in that space is so precious. And I think we can be a part of the journey in this space too as a church, if we're brave enough to have the conversations and brave enough to take the view that Jesus does. Not be the boundary riders, but the people creating the well with the water that others can come and drink from. Amen. I'm going to hand it to you.